So today is the second part of paradigms or language ideas that don't really fit into a bigger category. Right? So onward we go. So tons, I've distributed them. You can cut them out yourself and then have fun. So what is when programming something for the real world? Like, nothing in the real world is exact. Nothing is discrete. You do not know how large a tree is. You know it's plus minus 6 meters, plus minus a few centimeters. You never know anything exactly in the real world. You don't know how fast a car is going exactly. You know it's about 50 kilometers per hour, plus minus a little bit. Right? So, we need to be able to deal with uncertainties in when programming something for the real world, for embedded systems, for example. For this, we need programming languages that support uncertainty in a first level basis, in a first name basis. For example, we need statistical variables and potentially for something for the future, it's quantum variables. There is some research going on now for programming languages for quantum computers. You don't have quantum computers yet, so let's take this with a grain of salt, but still. What is real is fuzzy logic. Fuzzy logic is a fairly old concept for programming with uncertainties. So you're not sure in what category something belongs to. You don't know how large something is in a quantity. So uncertain categories and uncertain sizes of things. Right? So light is almost certainly quantum particle-based. Can we model that in a probabilistic or fuzzy logic? Or is it a bird, is it a plane, or is it Superman? You don't know what kind of category something is. Therefore, it's a fuzzy problem, fuzzy categorization. Right? So there's fuzzy logic rules, right, for inference with uncertain quantities. For example, if a pizza is good, and if it has good bread and it has good sauce, then you know that a pizza is good. But this is something subjective. You never know if something is really good and how good is it, right? Is it 100% good? Is it 80% good? You don't know. So some statement like this is inexact as well. So you need to be able to reason with inexact quantities. For a pizza parlor, right, you have uncertain quantities and you need to make actions with certainty, right? Or even then probabilistic actions. So the first idea here is to have intervals. Something is good if it's an interval between 90% sure and 100% sure, then something is good. If something is in the range of 50% to 80%, then we'll say it's probably okay. And if it's less than 50%, we say it's bad. Right, so this is the idea of interval-based logic. So we have a set of values, and something is a member of a set if it falls into a certain probabilistic range. Right, so set is ranges are mostly from 0 to 1, also from statistics. So yeah, this is related to constraint programming, only with intervals of truths. Right? So something is good. Bread is good if the weight of the bread is bigger than 100 and less than 200, right? And so on. If a bread is almost good, if it's somewhat the weight worse than 300, so it's a little too heavy. Right, so this gives a probabilistic ranges of good, not so good. Or do we say good, bad? Right, so is this a hard drop-off, or is this a gradual drop-off, right? That is something that we need to think about. If you say an AND of two statistic variables, is the minimum of the truth of X and the truth of epsilon of Y, right? Or is the OR for taking the maximum of some truth values, and 1 minus the truth of X. And truth of X then delivers the statistic probability of something to be truthful, of being true. This leads us to fuzzy facts, right? So how sure are you that a fact holds? I am 0.7 of one, I'm certain that John is tall, and I'm certain that John is swift if something is in the range of .6 to .8. Right, this leads us to fuzzy clauses. So now we're going into direction of prologue, right? We have clauses and rules with inference rules. So this goes towards prologue with fuzzy facts. Right, so somebody is a good player if he is tall and if he is swift. And UPA is then a probabilistic distribution of mapping this truth value and that truth value, merging those two together to give a resulting truth value. So UPA gives us a merge function of the two truth values and giving us a return truth value. Right, somebody is a good player if somebody is tall and swift, then we, for example, can do a maximum of tall and swift of John. That gives us a maximum if we know that guy was .7 and was a maximum of 0 and whatever it was in this range of John. And that gives us a truth range of John being a good player of .0, .3 to .5. Right, so we can compute with these things. Of course, we don't want hard drop-offs. We do not want hard drop-offs of something to be true or something to be false. We want soft drop-offs, soft gradient, gradual curves towards saying if something is true or false. Right, so we want something like this. If something is, we know something to be certainly true, and then a gradient, a slow drop-off until we know that something is false. So we know that something is good or something is bad, and there's something in between with a gradual drop-off. So how do we describe these gradual drop-offs, and how do we patch this into a language? So JFL. JFL is a fuzzy programming language where you can have uncertainties as a first-level, first-class entities. So a car is either new, old, or medium old. Right, and a car is either fast, slow, very fast, or something in the middle. Right? And then we need interval functions for saying when something is between new and medium, right? or old and medium in age. We need to have some sort of function that says how old is it, how old or how fast is something. Right? So here in medium we say, we give a curve for interval values and say what in this range is its speediness. So hedges, a hedge is a function for flow to float for mapping distributions of statistical values. So it's basically float and it returns you a float for an operator. So if you say something is good and something is fast, you need to be able to merge those two, and the function that merges two probabilistic values is then an operator. So you have your hedges, so not very around positively, so very certain, or centered around 0.5. This gives you distributions of statistical values. Everybody knows normal distribution, right? Or bell curves. What's the bell curve again? Something like this, right? So there are a number of curves, and we don't want to fix ourselves towards a single distribution. We want to be able to have multiple distributions of statistical values. This gives us some logic like this. So if speed is 0.7, then not speed, and it gives some sort of distribution of how good something matches to a given category. An example. Right, so this is the program, and here I've done an execution. Right, so first I give a domain. Right, for meters and floats, input is height, and height is a domain, and meters is a fuzzy with a defuzzing algorithm for averaging, and it gives a number of adjectives. So for somebody is medium height, small, extra tall. Right, and somebody is, and I want the result to be how good somebody is at basketball, and I want to be able to compute it. So if somebody is very tall, then I give him a bonus. If somebody is extra tall, then I want to give him an even higher bonus for being able to play basketball. So okay, then I run the fuzzy programming interpreter, the JFR. I give it an input. I say that the guy who wants to play basketball is 2 meters tall. 2 meters tall maps exactly to height is tall. And height is tall means he is a 5. So his output is a 5. So then I give 2.2. 2.2 maps to extra tall. So extra tall is 20, right? And now I give something in between, right? So in between 2.0 and 2.1. So somebody is in between tall and extra tall. Is something in between this guy and this guy. We know that 5, and we need something in between 5 and 20. And we said that the defuzzing is via averaging. So it takes the average between 5 and 20, giving 12 and a half. Right? The same for ideal weight for a male and a female. Right? So if somebody is male and weight is some, then it's his ideal weight is something. Somebody is female, then his ideal weight is something lower. Right? Then I give a, say something is male, and then a height, given height, and it'll compute my ideal weight. I cannot say that somebody is in between male and female because there are concrete categories. So, MATLAB. All of these fuzzy algorithms I can just as well code in normal math. I don't need a special programming language for it. Right? It's nice, right? It's a domain-specific language for dealing with uncertainties. It makes my programs a little smaller because I don't have to code many of these things, such as averaging, explicitly in my code. So it's a separation of concerns of managing uncertainties and specifying them, right? So it's a separation of concerns. If I leave those out, I can just program them, for example, with MATLAB. So the MATLAB is a language specifically designed for math. So it's close to math notation, it's almost functional. There are first level support for doing things like writing matrices in a nice format. For example, here, I define a matrix, right? This is easy enough. And I can plot them and show them and rotate and so forth. So there's lots of operations on matrices, like get some column of the matrix, map some operator to all the elements in a matrix, find something in a matrix, and so forth. So also map reduce built into the language, everything on matrices. There's call by value, so MATLAB is a normal programming language. You can call functions in them. You have multiple return value functions. They should be very familiar. You can also use intervals as variables, so this is mapped back to fuzzy programming. So we have intervals of things and you can compute with intervals. And then if you have an interval, you can apply a distribution towards that interval by just applying a distribution function over an interval and then get the same result as you saw in JFL. So JFL is consumed by something like MATLAB in a very concise fashion. Something else is GUI programming, right? Something, another paradigm that doesn't really fit into general programming. Do we really want programming languages with support for doing GUIs? Oh, yes, because the more I put into a language, the less I have to think. And thinking less is a good idea because every line of code you type is suspect for having bugs, right? The less I type, the less bugs I do. It's easy enough. So the idea is to separate the graphics from your implementation. And if you push that a little further, you have model view controller, where all three components are as separated as you can possibly do them. So the model is whatever your data structures are, view is what you see on the screen, and the controller is manipulating the model, right? Doing stuff with your keyboard, affects the model, and then it should show the results on the screen. There are some languages that try and push this model into the programming language. So you have programming language support for separating models, views, and controllers. So some step towards this is what Microsoft is doing with XAML. In XAML, you describe your interface. You say, I have a rectangle with a given name, and inside of your code, you can then refer to the stuff on your interface by its name. So the name is of a visual thing in the GUI is then by its name as an address separated from the code. So code and view are fairly nicely separated. This works fairly nicely. Here's a bit of XAML where I create a circle with a given name and some attributes, and then a text field with some attributes, and it'll show me a circle with a text box in my on my screen. But there's nothing controlling this stuff. There's no data structure associated with this data with this stuff. This is here. So this is the C# code that interfaces with this XAML code, and I do that via name. So it's say circle, and that references via its address the thing on the GUI. So the GUI and the model are now ideally separated, right? There's no direct reference here to please draw me a circle, please draw me a text box. That is all nicely separated. But the model and the view are separated. This works fairly nicely. JavaFX is actually dead, but it lives on in a number of other languages as language concepts. For example, Microsoft has Microsoft Link for integrating SQL into C#. So integrating SQL means they have some sort of data structure inside of your normal C# code, and then you can select some items from that data structure where some constraint holds, and that returns you a set of answers. Right? Or even do normal computation, select n squared from n in some sort of range, right? So built-in iterator support. So select statements as an alternative form for iterators. So JavaFX select only works for queries, not for updates. On Link, it also works for updates, if I'm not mistaken. So for example, you create a My Database object. From this database object, give all the products where some constraint holds, and then select that record to put it in the result. This is a fairly nice way of describing iterators over data structures. So you don't have to say while has next to do get next, as you would in Java. Access-oriented programming, also already talked a little bit about access-oriented programming. Newer languages have some support for access-oriented programming. It mostly looks something like this, where you have a trigger on where, whenever you see this statement being executed, please execute this statement. This is more the more modern view of access-oriented programming in programming languages. Many DSLs use something like this for when they have access-oriented programming. So when you see this statement being executed, please execute this statement as well. So this code here matches my trigger statement, meaning that this system out print line will be inserted after this assignment. So an assignment can have many side effects that are invisible. So there's a problem here with program understanding with access-oriented programming in general. Just executing some innocent-looking statement can cause a whole bunch of side effects that are invisible because they are triggered by some trigger statement somewhere else in the code. So this is a program understanding problem. Extents. A number of programming languages have extents. An extent is the set of all objects of a given type. For example, here I have in JavaFX had such a thing. There are a number of other programming languages that have extents as well. So for all strings in all allocated strings, print them. And so it runs over the whole memory, all of memory, finding every instance of a given type and then gives it to you in a set. So you never have to think about storage. Normally, when you say create a database, inside of your database application, you usually store lists of things so you can later find them again, right? We can just throw all that stuff out. Let's let the machine record what is live, what is living, and objects. So if you create a database of records, you just say new record and forget about it. And then sometime later, when you want to find all the records, you just iterate over the extent of all the record types and you find them again. So you never have to record what data structures are live in lists and maps and whatnot. It's all obsolete. Access-oriented programming. This is a little bigger in terms of a paradigm. So what is a program? In imperative programming, a program is a sequence of statements. In OOP, it's a set of objects and so forth. In aspect-oriented programming, you have a set of glued together functionalities. In general, you have a skeleton of your program, and you hang the meat of your program on top of the skeleton. A little bit like Frankenstein. So you have a bit of functionality and you glue all of those functionalities together. You have like disk IO, you have some compute code somewhere, you have a GUI, you have user input, you want to log whatever is happening in your application and so forth. And all of those are glued together on the skeleton to create the final program. Right. So why should we do aspect-oriented programming? Lots of people have commented that object-oriented programming has failed. Yeah, this was a flame war. But the idea of why people are saying this is most of the time, if you want to reuse a bit of code, that was one of the ideas of object-oriented programming, code reuse, then it doesn't really work because there are not just one object that you have to reuse, but you have to reuse methods of that object and a method of that object and a bit of code from that or somewhere over there. And then all that together is the functionality that you want to reuse. So you don't reuse classes or objects in object programming. You use single pieces of snippets of code. And that is together a functionality. And that is what you want to can reuse. So reuse functionality. You don't reuse single objects. That's the comment for the comment against object-oriented programming. You see something like aspect-oriented programming in the Linux kernel. Every few days, somebody sends a patch to Linus for please add this to your kernel code. And a patch is in effect a bit of functionality. So whenever you see a patch, you can think of that patch instead of not just a difference in lines of text, we can think of that as added functionality. The problem here is whenever two patches change the same file at the same time. So I write something in a file, somebody else makes a change in that file almost at the same location, and then there is a conflict of interest, right? I do something, I want a change and he wants a change. Which change are we going to get? Right, so the problem here is that patches aren't structured. And that is where aspect-oriented programming comes in. For defining what should win in case of a conflict, what should go in what order, and whatnot. Another way of managing this is via the preprocessor. You see a lot of this, in where you have lots of defines for if something, if this version, then do that. If that version, then do that. This leads to very unstructured code where you have these if statements for the preprocessor all over your code to manage the different versions of things. Getting away from all of this if dev stuff, that is a good goal. That is where aspect-oriented programming has a chance. But it's weave in the version that you want for a given target. So the idea here, cross-cutting concerns. Right? If you want to add a functionality, you don't add it in one place in the code, then you need to add that change in many, many different places in the code. So there's many files that you need to change to add some functionality. Then there is what aspect-oriented programming then wants to do is have a tool that patches your your source code to add this functionality at the required places. You as a as the programmer of the framework, of the skeleton of your program, only have to say, this is a place in the code where, in my skeleton, where something can be attached. So you as a skeleton programmer need to say where the attachment points are, and as the aspect programmer, you say, please attach this bit of functionality to that place in the skeleton. An argument against aspect-oriented programming is program understanding, right? You program your skeleton, but you have no idea what will be attached to the skeleton, right? So you don't know if the skeleton is programmed in such a way that it is flexible enough to allow later attachment. And, some examples. So this AOP is for this aspect C++ for adding aspects to C++. So you have a bit of code, main calls zoo, zoo calls printf, and then you have an aspect that states, please insert before seeing a zoo method invocation this aspect. So it sees this zoo invocation here, and before this zoo invocation, we'll insert this printf here. So printf aspect and then invoke zoo. Right. Now you can not only insert something before a method invocation, you can also insert something after a method invocation, before an object allocation, around something else. So here, for example, I want to insert this printf before seeing this zoo invocation and this aspect 2 after this zoo invocation. This proceed is then a placeholder for this instance of this call invocation that you, this call that you to zoo that you saw somewhere in the code. Just inserting code isn't very useful if you're not able to change data structures as well. So here, what I want to do is not only insert a print something after a call, but also insert a new constructor or a new field into the class wherever this aspect applies. So here I find a place in the code where a zoo invocation occurs, and whenever that happens, something here, zoo is called, and in the class holding this main method, I want to insert this constructor in this value as well. So I can change the context of where insertion happens as well. Point cut. So a point cut is a place in the code where you need to insert some code. All right, so here I have my printf again, and I have point cut is the place in the code where either zoo or bar is called. When we see either one of these function calls, that states where this aspect should apply. Right. So I have one aspect inherit from another aspect. So I have inheritance over aspects as well. So when you declare a field in an aspect thus far, it's declared in the global scope, so there's no influence yet over scoping in which context I want to insert something in its applied context. Let's say we have an example. We have a linked list class, a naive linked list class, and I want to extend that class with a functionality to count the size of the list. So I want to add a getSize method to this list class, and I want to have a counter field to count how many things are in the list. That is what I want to do. So I start with a simple linked list, that's with a nodes and head and list, list constructor, an add method, and something that prints the list. And now I want to extend this class to count how many elements are in the list. So I want to extend the functionality of the list. But I don't want to touch the original list class, right? I don't want to edit the list class. So the first thing I need to do is state where insertion should happen, right? So I have an aspect element counter. This is what I want to add to the functionality to my original list. So I should add a counter and it should add the getSize method. I have an advice from when you see the add method of the list class, then at the end of the list of that method, I should insert the add a list counter and do a print that it's now the counter has incremented. In the end of the constructor, at the beginning of the constructor, I should initialize the counter. So now I have separated the basic implementation of the linked list from the functionality of counting how many elements are in the list. Right? Aspect J is the same thing as Aspect C++, but then for Java. So adding aspects to Java code. It has almost the same concepts and ideas, so it's not much new here. The same point cuts is for defining points in the code where an insertion can happen. So point cut is at the invocation of foo. I want to is a point in the code where something can be inserted. After this foo invocation, greet here is after this point in the code, I want to insert this print statement. So this tester foo is here, and after this invocation of foo, I should insert this aspect print line. Where aspect orientation shines is in adding debug statements, adding logging statements. So where you don't really want to make your code dirty by inserting all of these print line statements all over your code. And then once you've done debugging, you have to remove all of these print line statements all over your code again. So all this work, all these minutiae are overhead that you don't want to add. So push this in an aspect, and once you've done with debugging, just remove your aspect or weave it in the final executable, and you're done. So for a logger class, for example, I want to log every invocation of something else. So for all the public methods, I define all the public methods in my tester class as points in the code where something should be inserted. Entry call main is an entry point in the code where execution starts. That is where I want to insert something. So point cuts define points in the code where something can be inserted. And I can use these point cuts when inserting code. So before all the loggable calls, insert this print line statement, and after these loggable calls, insert another print line statement. So I can add very, very simply add profiling to my code. If I want to know where is the time spent in my code without having to rely on a separate profiler, I can just weave in an aspect to measure execution times. We had the example for adding the counter to the list in C for C++. Let's do the same for aspect Java. For aspect J, you have your list again with a node class and an add, the same as we saw in aspect C++. Then we define a list counter aspect. We define the parent, so we want the new class, or the instrumented class, to implement our countable interface. So we want to add an implements clause to wherever this aspect is applied to. So we want to create public class mylist implements countable. Right? So we want to extend the class where we weave something in. And then we want to add this counter and this getSize method. We define a location where we want to add something to our skeleton. And then we say what we want to add to that point in the code. Dependency injection. This is something related to weaving. In weaving, was inserting a specific bit of code in a specific place in some skeleton code. In injection, I want to weave in an object allocation at some point in the code. And I want to later specify what should be injected. So at runtime, I want to say what is weaved, instead of where a normal aspect J does is weave something statically. I want, when you weave something normally, you take this bit of concrete code and weave it in. In dependency injection, I want to at runtime say what should be weaved in at a, for a specific object allocation. So for example, here I have a class which allocates a counter, and I want to at runtime decide which counter object will be allocated there. I want to at runtime decide which counter implementation should be allocated. So the first step is, instead of using fixed counters, perhaps it's better to use interfaces. Right? So I have an interface counter. So here I say counter interface X, and then finish. And then say, please at runtime add the code to instantiate a new implementation of this counter interface and assign it to this X over there. So this is another way of separating concerns, right? The implementation concern from the more abstract black box interface concerns. So how this usually works is I annotate my field declaration with inject to say that at runtime, please instantiate whatever you wanted at this place in the code. So you say, you create then at runtime and some sort of XML which says, please instantiate a counter implementation of that type and assign the new instance over there. Right? And this is at runtime converted to something like this. Right? So this is weaved in with that together to create that, but then at runtime. Okay. Let's step towards web programming. Web programming is something very new. Everybody needs to be able to do web programming now. So what is different in web programming? We'll go into this in a historical fashion. First, everybody was doing Perl, then PHP, then and now we're doing HTML5, Goose, Spring, and so forth. So we'll start at the bottom and then work our way towards the present. In general, how it always works is you have your web browser, it sends you a URL with some arguments towards the web server. The web server somehow accepts your HTTP request, extracts the contents of your URL, finds out what it should send back, and then sends it back. What in these Perl approaches is, you have some sort of CGI script, which the web server sees your request ends with CGI, sends it towards your Perl CGI script interpreter. This reads it from standard input and emits the resulting web page on standard out. It does print line, print line, print line for your HTTP and HTML. So what is Perl? How does Perl work? So Perl is a scripting language, imperative. It's very concise in that hashes and lists are built into the language, so arrays are built into the language. There are short forms for saying when something is an array or when something is a hash. So if you prefix a variable with a percent sign, it means that this variable is a hash. You shouldn't use mix these prefixes. All of these prefixes define a separate namespace. So if you say procent x equals something, and then later say dollar x, it means these are two different variables, right? Because they live in different namespaces. So you should be very careful with your prefixes. There are regular expressions built into the language. So we have some magic like this as a statement. which says something like filter some string by matching some other strings. We'll look at how these things work in a bit. So $ gave us scalar variables, such as integers, strings, normal variables. We can undefine a variable that we've previously declared. Everything lives in a global namespace. So everything is a global variable, in effect. So arrays and hashes, if I prefix something with at from array, then it defines an array. I can print these things even if they are inside of a string. So it's fairly convenient. You have your loops and iterators as normal. So strings are mutable in Perl. In Java, they're all immutable. Instantiate a string object, you can't change it. Whenever you do something with a string in Java, you create a new string, right? In Perl, strings are mutable, so I create $1 is a scalar, right? It's a new line of text, print it, chomp it. Chomp it means throw away this slash n by removing superfluous non-printable characters. And then I create a new string. Right? Arrays can be used as stacks and as queues, so I can push and pop elements onto an array and from an array. So here I create an array stack with ABC, and I can push something on the stack. Right? And I can pop something from a stack as well. So arrays are a little bit abused for multiple purposes. And then shift and unshift items from the stack. So as expected. File.io is fairly normal as well. Open some file or die. Normally you say if not open, then die. But in Perl, you can turn this around and say open and then pipe the result of that to this or. This is sort of the other way around. So while defined something, iterate, this is fairly normal. Formatted output, fairly normal as well. You have your date for something. This is an array, right? This is my array with some values in it. And then write it, and then format they say $@, some at sign is then the number of digits that you want to print after the dot. Right, so text replacement. Now we're getting towards regular expressions. So $ means now comes a regular expression. And then you say text replace, and then you give a search string, slash another search string, and then you give a number of options. Right, and then this regular expression will be applied to string. So x $a means apply the regular expression a on x and give a new value, a new array or a new string. Right, so for example, I have a string something, and then I do a text replace of a, b, c, d by 0, 1, 2, 3. And if I execute that, then a, b, c, d is replaced by 0, 1, 2, 3. That works. So more regular expression. We have filters. So we can either search something or do a text replace. So here I want to search in a monkey string var and so forth. So these regular expressions can be used as search criteria for finding something in a string. So if this string contains a search string, then execute something else if you can't find it. So these regular expressions are everywhere in a Perl program. So you here define a string, and then if this string contains ABC, do something, and so forth. So $ampersand is the substring that caused the success in finding something in a regular expression. So define my string again, and here I refer to with $ampersand to the match result in another regular expression. So I can refer to old regular expressions results indirectly. So procedure invocation is almost like we had in shell script. In shell script, we had positional arguments indexed by arguments found by indices, right? I can refer to this third argument or the fourth argument. I don't refer to arguments or parameters by name as you would in Java. So for example, here I don't say how many arguments foo has. I just say I have a function foo, a subroutine foo, and I give it some arguments and I refer to them by their index in their called in the called order. This allows me to create polymorphic functions, right? So a polymorphic function was a function that I can call with arbitrary arguments, and the callee should be able to handle them somehow. So these are polymorphic functions. So I have pattern matching for arrays for a little bit, where I given an array. So this is the first argument in a first array argument. And then I want to extract from the array, from the argument array, the A and the first two arguments from the parameters. So this would be call it with 2 and 3. At underscore, I get the arguments as an array. Extract the first two arguments. So this is 2 and 3 for A and B. So okay, so far for the basics of Perl. From regular expressions, now towards how to apply that to a web server. How do I use Perl to create a web server or a web service? The first step is HTML. Everybody here knows HTML. You create some structured text with some code in it, and then I can invoke a Perl script directly by referring to it by its location on the server. And this will be executed or invoked by the web server, and then the output of that is returned to the web browser. So here's the code of my example. All right, I create my Perl script, I read from standard in some environment variables, and then I do a number of print statements to create proper HTML as output. And then for each key in my environment, I print the environment variable. It'll return hello there from here, right? So body hello there, and then it'll dump the environment variables here, right? For each environment variable, return its key and its value. Perl is fairly low level, and it's not very portable in the sense that I cannot merge my Perl script easily with some JavaScript somewhere else. So it's old. Nobody uses Perl anymore except for some low-level tweakery. Everybody then moved from Perl to PHP. So in Perl scripts, you require two files, right? And what I want to do is inline my Perl script, my PHP inside of the web page that requested it. So I only write my code once in one file instead of having multiple files. So it's a little bit easier in terms of management. So it's a tighter integration. There's no admin rights required because don't really require to run something on the server. So variables, let's look at how PHP works. Variables, it's like a little bit like Perl, and this is a sort of a scripting language. It's untyped dynamic, as we expect these scripting languages to behave. So here I can create an array object, index my array, get things from an array, print things, and so forth. Fairly conventional. I have associative arrays, just as we had with Perl and Python. So I can index an array with different types of objects. I can index an array with another array and with a string and so forth, with another object. Control flow is like we know it from imperative languages. There is some controversy in PHP for doing parallelism, the same as you do for JavaScript. JavaScript does not allow parallel programming. I cannot create a number of threads in my web browser to do some computation. So the upside to this is that I cannot write a malicious web page that somehow in the background starts a task to do lots of heavy computation and Bitcoin mining and give me coins, right? So there is some reasoning behind this. So how this works is I first create my HTML. This is my request page. In that request page, I type a little bit of PHP. And how this works is this PHP is taken out by the server and replaced by whatever this PHP script prints. So this is cut, executed, generate some output, and that output is pasted back. That is how it works. So I create some array, I have a normal switch statement. Switches can be on strings, on what arbitrary values, so it's more like a case statement instead of a switch statement. So object orientation is like Java in PHP, so I have classes, private variables, constructors. This is normal object-oriented programming. There's nothing really strange going on. Exceptions, like we know in Java, with your throw statement, and you have exception hierarchies. You have this PHP integration is fairly tight, so you can create your forms and refer to PHP scripts directly or indirectly, and replay and place the results of a PHP invocation inside of a form, for example. So it's JavaScript. Everybody here should be doing JavaScript. Nobody should be doing C++ anymore. In MIT, right, the first year students at MIT are now learning JavaScript instead of Java because Java is too old. Java is how old? 15 years? It's too old. So the web is moving far too fast for doing just Java still. Everybody should be doing JavaScript. So how does JavaScript work? It's imperative, object-oriented programming, but the language is an absolute mess. It's absolutely the worst. How this works is somebody started developing JavaScript and he thought, oh, maybe we should add that feature. No, well, let's add it. There's no restraint on the guy. And he added whatever he wanted to add. And sometimes design by committee helps. That is the message. So like PHP, you have inline scripts, so you write your HTML, and then somewhere in your HTML, you write a section for JavaScript. The server takes this whole thing, evaluates what's going on, and then returns the result. Or even the browser can, right? So the browser takes your JavaScript section and replaces it by its output and then renders the result. That's how it works. So control flow is normal. You have your global document, and this document is then the current HTML for its result value, right? So whatever is written here is written in what is in place of this script section. So I have calls with multiple arguments. At least now we have named arguments or ABC instead of just positional arguments or indexed arguments that we had with Perl. If a document write, normal for loops, function calls as normal. So far, it's okay. This prototype-based object orientation. This is where JavaScript gets a little weird. So you have prototype-based object orientation. What does that mean? Functions can be used as both functions and as constructors, depending on their context. So how you use something defines what it means. So here I say new stack. Because I say new stack, that means that stack must not be a function, it must be a constructor. However, if I somewhere else in the code say the stack is normal, then stack must be a function and invoke it as a normal function again. So depending on how I use something, it means something else. This is a little weird. So this is defining a class, because I use it as a class. Right? So a little careful. So inheritance is via explicit reference assignments of base classes. This is a little bit as it's used in, I've forgotten the name, okay. It's by direct management of the class hierarchy. So here I say stack.prototype is new countable, which means that stack must have a base class of countable. So at runtime, define what the class hierarchy should be. Even worse, I can per object decide what the object hierarchy should be. Because here I can allocate a stack, right? And then sometime later in the code, I say stack.prototype is new something else, and then define a new object hierarchy. Right, so because this is a normal statement, I can just do if condition, then my class hierarchy should be this, else my class hierarchy should be something else. So I can dynamically decide what my class hierarchy should be. That's a little tricky. Right. So adding methods to a field is via explicit addition. So like a scripting language, function is a class or a constructor because it's used as a class somewhere else, because I say new stack somewhere. I say new stack, and therefore this must be a class. Because it's a class, I now can add fields to the class dynamically. I never say this class should have these fields. It's like a scripting language. I never have to declare something. It's dynamically declared. So here is the first assignment to this dot data, and therefore this should have a field data. So fields are dynamically instantiated. Right. Here I say stack.prototype.push is my stack push. Here I dynamically define a method of my class. So here I define new stack, means stack must be a class, and here I assign methods to my class. So no function is implicitly a method of a class. I must explicitly manage my class hierarchy, and I must explicitly add methods to my class as well. Right? So I dynamically create my framework by assignment of methods to classes and objects and so on. It's a very tight browser and scripting language integration. So the browser implements a JavaScript interpreter, and which intercepts these blocks of scripts, interprets them, and replaces them by their results. So if you do view source after your post-processing of JavaScript, you can see the result of these print lines. Okay, that's it for today.